has joined. Has joined.
Hello.
Hello.
Music stopped. Okay, music stopped. I've never had that before. And no sound.
I was busy looking for the location, but I found it. So,
okay.
Are you the only one?
No.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Our class this afternoon is continuing our study of the evolution of God. We're in section 4, chapter 3, Understanding the Sephirot, the First Triad. We'll start with the L'shem Yehud. L'shem Yehud kun shabarichu ishkinte bitkilu urchimu utkilu utkilu urchimu le'akta l'shem yudhe bavavhe. Yehuda shalim b'shem kol Yisrael, limud Torah mitzvah, lasok Torah mitzvah. Vayhino amadonai Eloheinu elein amaseh yadenu kononeh elein amaseh yadenu kononehu. Understanding the Sephirot, the First Triad, Chapter 3 of Section 4. Before we continue discussing the Sephirot, let us digress for a moment to define mysticism. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines mysticism as the belief that direct knowledge of Hashem, spiritual truth, or ultimate reality can be attained through subjective experience, as intuition or insight. And vague speculation, a belief without sound basis. Both of these definitions postulate a subjective reality, one that can only be known to the individual. Knowledge of this type was not acquired through an academic interpretation of human interactions with the outside world. Mystical knowledge is, by definition, something learned through self-introspection, inner contemplation, and intuitive insights. As such, mystical knowledge rises up from within the depths of the human psyche, as compared to scientific knowledge that is learned from the outside to the exclusion of any personal, internal interpretations. Opposite mysticism, we have science. Science is defined as knowledge about or study of the natural world based on facts learned through experiments and observation. Scientific knowledge must be verifiable. Mystical knowledge, by definition, is internal and can thus never be subject to experimental or observable verification. Scientific knowledge defines the objective reality of the universe surrounding us. Mystical knowledge defines the subjective reality of the universe as perceived by the human psyche. Scientific and mystical knowledge are both equally real and valid. However, thank you.
I can put it on the table. Thank you very much. Have a beautiful afternoon.
Scientific and mystical knowledge are both equally real and valid. However, they describe things in totally opposite, often contradictory ways. They are like two sides of the same coin or two halves to the same circle. Both are necessary to see the greater whole, and it is the very definition of imbalance to see only one side at the expense of the other. Understanding the Sephirot requires one to balance both a scientific, cognitive behavioral, and mystical, archetypal, psychological point of view. Often these two are viewed as mutually exclusive. However, the two opposites need to be integrated as one, because they both emanate from the singular source of the human mind. The human mind is our human source of all knowledge and experience, be it internal or external, intuitive or academic, natural or supernatural. Our human brain, our mind, is the singular receiver and the transmitter that enables each individual to have awareness, and to learn this is not a philosophical concept. This is indeed a psychological fact. Two modes of human consciousness and learning have been recognized and known since early Grecian times. In modern times, science has come to understand the workings of the two lobes of the brain. Public knowledge of this dual-lobed brain has given rise to the popular cultural expression of right brain and left brain thinking. There is nothing new in any of this cerebral activity. Psychologically, this is as old as the human species. Philosophically and psychologically, this awareness is thousands of years old. It is the explanation as to why men and women think and perceive life differently from one another, and also explains the marked difference of perception between the scientist and the artist. There are two modes of consciousness. Some call them two actual brains. For the Kabbalists, the two modes and the two brains are represented by two Sephirot. The two Sephirot are numbers 2 and 3 of the 10, and form two-thirds of the first pyramidic triad of Sephirotic arrangement. These two are named Hakma and Bina, respectively. I'm going to stop here and give you some additional, my own perceptions of what Rabbi Bar Sadak has said. Science takes experimentation. Experimentation requires a hypothesis. You are testing the hypothesis. The hypothesis comes from a human brain. If your hypothesis has different words defining the hypothesis, the experiment will be structured differently, and the outcome can be different. But once an outcome has been developed, based on the hypothesis that is being tested, if that can be duplicated. But the source of the scientific hypothesis is intuition. fruition. Why does the question arise in the scientist's mind that he then determines, oh, I need to experiment to find out and test this hypothesis? This is the unity of the science and the mystical. The mystical cannot be duplicated because it is your perception. So we need to understand that science, while it can be duplicated, it's essentially coming from the same source as the mystical knowledge. It's coming from the intuition. Why did the scientist ask that question in that way? The majority of people do not recognize this, and therefore they perceive science and mystical knowledge as two different things. Those who are oriented to science find great difficulty in accepting the mystical interpretations, the mystical knowledge, because it cannot be duplicated, and many times will seem to go against it. Logic. It will seem to go against the perception. It will not, sometimes will not be easily verifiable through experimentation. Let me use as an example telepathy, or in modern terms, distant viewing. All of the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, have been experimenting with distant viewing, where a psychic can sit in a room in a comfortable couch and view the internal labyrinth of the Kremlin. And he can follow that internal labyrinth of the Kremlin to its storage locations. And he can then see inside the file cabinets. And he can see the words on the papers in the files. And he returns from that travel, which is all mental. He has never moved from that physical location. And he reports what he saw. Now the technicians in the CIA attempt to verify it through other means of intelligence gathering. And they determine the amount of time that they can verify what the person was saying he saw or she saw. And they act on that based on the probabilities and the statistics and the history of that particular psychic. Now, that sounds like a lot of effort for no benefit, but the benefit is quite real. If you discover that your enemy is about to embark on a war and you have really no verification until you've seen the email that's in the file in the drawer saying it's the date is such and such. Some people will say, well, he's making it up. He can't be right. All of these different attacks on the individual psychic. Others will accept the psychic because he has a history of being correct. Yes, he's not clear often. He's not clear all the time. but his percentage of accuracy is high. I'm trying to give you an understanding of how science and experimentation verification can be applied to both systems and is being applied to both systems. Where it gets a little uncomfortable for the scientist is when the psychic says, I've seen what I've seen in the spiritual worlds. I've seen people, not humans, in other dimensions. How can it be verified? And that's what the issue is for the scientists. For the people making their decisions in the physical world, based on the information they're being presented with. If someone says to you, so-and-so just got the vaccine, the COVID vaccine, how do you know? You ask the person. They told me. Do you trust the person who's giving you the information? The Torah tells us, assume that it's correct, but don't act on it until you've verified it. And that is the issue that we have to resolve. If you have a person who's accurate in his psychic information, and you verified that in this world, can you doubt that the information in the other dimensions is accurate? Yes, you can doubt it, because you have no way to verify it. And maybe seeing that distance, the accuracy is not as strong, is not as great. These are the issues that each individual must arrive at in order to determine for themselves, will you use the information derived from the mystical processes? Does anyone have any questions about what I've said up to this point? Questions, comments, thoughts on this? Otherwise, I will just continue reading with respect to the upper triad, which we have not yet defined, but we're starting to get into, because he's applied the names Chachma and Bina to the number 2 and number 3 Sephirot. I'm continuing to read. Now it is important for us to remember here that the entire Kabbalistic system is an expression of the artistic system of the artistic mind. Kabbalah, in using modern jargon, is right brain thinking. Its language is metaphorical, symbolic, and intentionally rich with archetypal imagery. Forget this, and you might as well forget Kabbalah, but we cannot do this. Kabbalah is the artistic side of Judaism, as Talmud is the rational, scientific side. One without the other leaves one half-brained, with all the negative connotations of the modern slang meaning of the term. The Sephirotic names Chachma and Bina are artistic, archetypal, metaphorical expressions for the two modes of human consciousness and thinking. Their names are only the smallest of labels that fit over the grander concepts that they represent. Translating their names into English, Chokhma translates to the word wisdom, and Bina translates to the word understanding. Yet these names alone do little to explain the depths of these concepts and what they represent. Chokhma is also called the Sephirotic face, or the Partsuf Abba, father, and Bina is called Ima, mother. As we shall see, this gender application to these mental attributes will be very enlightening about their true nature and revealing much to us as to how the Kabbalists view both human genders and which mode of thinking more properly belongs to which gender. To digress for a moment, the reader will notice that we are specifically interpreting the Sephirot within the context of their internal psychological application. Many Kabbalistic theorists have for centuries philosophically speculated about the true nature of the Sephirot, trying to comprehend what exactly is the relationship of the Sephirot to the Creator himself, or herself, or itself. The theories have run the gamut from one extreme to the other, with the Sephirot being part and parcel, one with God, to the opposite, with the Sephirot being completely detached and apart from God. All of these speculations form a body of Kabbalistic literature that has for centuries been the place of a heated debate and controversy. In the 1570s, Rabbi Chaim Vital taught in the name of his master, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, known as the Ari, that since the days of the Ramban, Nachmanides, died in 1270, no Kabbalist, other than with rare exceptions, had divine inspiration or the revelation of Elijah, the prophet. As such, all their Kabbalistic works are to be considered unreliable and unworthy of studying. While some have ignored the Ari's admonition, many Kabbalists, faithful to the Ari to this day, pay heed and refuse to study any of the philosophies that the Ari disdained. The discussion about the nature of the Sephirot and their relationship to the ultimate unity of God is for these Kabbalists a non-issue, one that is discussed only by those who in their eyes have no divine inspiration to reveal to them the truth that these other Kabbalists are so sure that they themselves possess. However, for many other Kabbalists and non-Kabbalists alike, the concept of Sephirot as being emanations of God is a troubling philosophical challenge to their understanding of God's unity. This level of discussion brings us into the realm of theology, a realm which we wish to avoid. Therefore, in this material, rather than delve into the philosophical, which includes all theology, and get lost in the theoretical and impractical, I have chosen to follow the path of those Kabbalists who interpret and apply the Sephirot to inner reality, and who leave the external realities alone. In this light, the Sephirot make the most sense, at least to Rabbi Bar Sadok, and pose no threat to literalist Orthodox philosophy and blunt religious dogma. My comment would add that, in my opinion, these intuitive insights give you reasons behind each and every action associated with that Orthodox methodology. Continuing. When we discuss Chokhma and Bina, we are talking about emanations that come forth from the unknowable God. However, the place of these emanations is what is important. The place of emanation is, like we have been saying, inside human beings and inside of all sentient life. Rather than argue philosophy, which at most simply expresses personal points of view, we can here relate information that can be referenced and experienced within our daily normal lives. We ourselves thus become the proof and the validation of the internal reality that we explore. The Sephirot explain how sentient life, and not just humanity, each in its own way, reflects its own unique reflection of the internal image of Hashem. Let me make a comment. The language that Rabbi Bar Sadok uses in this above paragraph is very limiting. He's trying to explain, or at least making the effort to explain, the intuitive descriptions of Chokhma and Bina, that where they come from, the internal minds, and they're being representing as the right column and the left column. This interpretation and this understanding is an attempt to make a scientific perspective out of the two Sephirot. If one is doing the experience, allowing the experience to connect to him, having his or her own experience, there is no need to define it this way, because I have defined it in our previous commentary. Chokhma and Bina are functions, yet functions of what? Without understanding the source, the cause, and the purpose of a function, how much can one truly understand about the function itself? The Sephirotic diagram does not begin with Chokhma and Bina. These are the second and third Sephirot, respectively. There is a first Sephirah from which Chokhma and Bina emanate. This Sephirah is the source, the cause, and the purpose underlying Chokhma and Bina. This first Sephirah is called Keter, crown, and its name reveals some very important facts about it. Keter is the first Sephirah. Yet in order to properly understand what it is, it was necessary to first introduce Chokhmah and Bina, which emanate from it. The Sefirah Keter is given all kinds of strange metaphoric names, each of which adds to our understanding of its true identity. Keter is in one place called Adam Kadmon, primordial man. In another place, it is called Arikanpin, the long face of God. These names are not overlaps, but refer to different subjective Keters in the overall scheme of the Sephirotic worlds. Yes, there are many repeating patterns of the 10 Sephirot. 10 is the general number, similar to the first nitrogen basis in DNA, the four proteins titled A, T, G, and C, Sephirot repeat and repeat. As the name means, Keter is a crown. A crown naturally sits on top of the head and is very clearly not a part of the head or of the body at all. The metaphor of Keter therefore indicates to us a level that is above us, yet it's still connected to us, and from which comes the higher realms of human thought, which are Chokhmah and Bina. Now let's have some discussion. Chokhmah, as we said, translates as wisdom. Bina, as we said, translates as understanding. Is there wisdom without understanding? It's a valid question. Is there understanding without wisdom? Another valid question. What is the difference between Keter and Arikantin? As we know in Hebrew words, letters, to have a different name, there's no synonyms. It cannot be the same thing, even though Rabbi Bar Sadduk is indicating that it is. And it's not. The difference is the individual Sephirah is called Chokhmah. It's called Bina. It's called Keter. When there is a structure, a complete structure of 10 Sephirot, there is a different name. It is the same level, but it has a complete structure associated with it. Then, therefore, Keter is called Arikanpin, because it has a structure of 10 Sephirot. And Chokhmah has a structure of 10 Sephirot, is called Abba. And Bina, when it has a structure of 10 Sephirot, is called Bina. If I confuse that, it's really... We have three partsufim. Faces. The word partsufim means a face. And a face, by definition, is a structure of 10 Sephirot. So Keter is Arikanpin. Chokhmah is Abba, the father, and Bina is the mother. Continuing where we left off. In Kabbalistic literature, Keter as Adam Kadmon, I didn't define what the worlds were called. The world is of Keter is a structure of 10 Sephirot. but it is not fully fulfilled. That's the definition of a world. It's actually the definition of a world is when the world, when the Sephirot, when the Partsuf is completely fulfilled, because each Sephirah is a desire. When all the desires are fulfilled, the world is complete. When it's not fully conceived, not fully fulfilled, it is still called Adam Kadmon, but not yet fulfilled. And because we don't ever specify that the worlds are not fulfilled, it leads to confusion. But we don't specify that the worlds are not fulfilled, primarily because they almost never are fulfilled fully. But you have these three words, Keter, Arichanpin, and Adam Kadmon. The individual Partsuf, excuse me, the individual Sephirah is Keter. The Partsuf, a structure of 10 Sephirot, is Abba. The world is Adam Kadmon. And this applies to all three. There's Keter with its two dynamic words, Arichanpin and Adam Kadmon. Then there is Chachma with its two words, which is Abba, a structure of 10 Sephirot, and the world of Atzilut. And Bina, with its as an individual Sephirah, as a structure of 10 Sephirot, it is Ima, mother. And the world is that of Briah, creation. Continuing to read. In Kabbalistic literature, Keter, as Adam Kadmon, is considered to be the primordial pattern underlying all of existence. Adam Kadmon is the personified metaphor used to describe Keter. Adam Kadmon is commonly abbreviated to AK, but in other places, AK means Altakacher, old person. AK is the general Sephirot of Keter. It is the general Keter because there are many subjective Keters at each of the individual levels. What that just said is that you have a Keter that is the cosmic level, the highest level of Keter. But then in Chachma, you have a Keter also. Well, you have a crown, the ultimate highest level crown, and then you have a lower level crown. But how does that relate to each other? How does one crown relate to another? We will discover as through our reading. But just as a hint, the Keters are constantly communicating. So what happens to one Keter impacts and affects them all, which is really the explanation for why human activity can impact the rest of the world. Continuing still. Remember, we are dealing with highly intricate and complicated symbolic metaphors. It is important that one remember what the metaphors are referring to in order not to become confused or to misunderstand the Kabbalistic lesson. In the personal psychological scheme of things, Adam Kadmon is the individual unconscious higher self. Keter, Adam Kadmon is the will, the desire that defines identity. This is true at both the macrocosmic level in Kabbalistic theory, as well as in the microcosmic level in psychological Kabbalistic application. The fact that the Kabbalists refer to the inner psychological higher self by the term Keter, signifying its position on the body, but not part of it, symbolizes their understanding of the individual, the human higher self. The higher self is considered one's true identity, the kernel, the seed, and seed of one's being. However, this higher essence and source is not fully manifest within human consciousness. On the contrary, it is even above, or better to say, deeper than the accessible layers of the unconscious. The Keter level within us, this higher self is said to be part of us, and yet part of something higher. Centuries after the Kabbalah formatted these concepts, the famous analyst Carl Jung came along and discovered this reality psychologically. He referred to this as the collective unconscious, and postulated that at a very deep level of the unconscious, all human beings are somehow integrally connected. Thus, the individual soul is both part and parcel of oneself, one's higher self, and at the same time, it is part and parcel of the grander collective soul or unconscious that unites all humankind. It is taught that all human souls were originally one and united in Adam. Adam is considered a metaphor for all humanity, and not just a singular individual, as one would interpret literally from the Bible. This concept of the apparent unity of collective humanity is shared by both Jung and the Kabbalists before him. Keter, Chachma, and Bina form the first pyramidic triad of Sephiroth. Keter is the Adam Kadmon, the primordial man within the higher self, which is both the source of our individuality and our connection to the collective, like the unknowable Keter of the macrocosm. The microcosmic Keter within us lies at the root of the unconscious. Keter can never become conscious. This is why Keter is symbolized as the crown. Keter is above consciousness, and thus is symbolized being above the body. Yet it rests on the body, and it is connected to it. Just because Keter is above consciousness certainly does not mean that Keter has no expression or manifestation. When Keter wishes to express itself, it projects will or desire into Chachma. Chachma is intuition. It is the unconscious. Chachma perceives an inner message of will or desire being sent from the Keter above. Bina, in turn, contemplates the intuited unconscious message, making rational sense of it. Bina, the logical mind, then devises the plan, the thought of how to best implement the idea that arises from unconscious Chachma, with its source in Keter, This mental process describes the function of meditation. Thus, we have the pyramidic triad of soul, the Keter, the higher self, the intuitive thought, Hokmah, the unconscious, and rational mind, Bina, the initial structure of the Sephirotic tree, and first order of the image of God within us all. The two modes of thinking, Hokmah and Bina, give rise to both mysticism and science. What starts out as mystical and mysterious in Hokmah must become both clear and rational in Bina. And this is how Hokmah bonds with and merges into Bina. This is the natural process of human thought and mental development. This is why both mysticism and science need to go together hand in hand. What begins as mystical speculation must, after careful consideration, contemplation, and experimentation, end up becoming scientific fact. This is how Keter, our own higher selves, make known to us discovery and creativity. Both are needed. Mysticism is a means to an end. Science is that end. Mysticism must never forget what the goal is, and science must never forget where the path to discovery begins. This paragraph is too limiting, but we're going to let it stand for now. The reason I say it is too limiting is because the thought in the unconscious can come down to the conscious, where it is developed, evaluated, fleshed out, and a plan is created. In that sense, the unconscious thought is manifest in Bina. The unconscious thought starts in Hokmah, gets manifested in Bina. But there's another process, or another part of the process. Because once the plan is created or manifested in Bina, it needs to be sent back into Hokmah, where it can be intuitively assessed. Will this work? Is this the best way for it to work? From which there will be another cycle of coming down to Bina with the changes. But the Keter has never been left out. And that's what we constantly need to remember. So when we send the first plan back to Hokmah, we are also communicating to the Keter from both the left brain and the right brain. This is the process. What does the Keter do with it? With the two different perceptions, the Bina perception and the Hokmah perception of the plan? It takes it back to the initial plan, the initial thought. Where is it in the plan of creation? The plan of creation is the Keter as it applies to the individual, but it's also the Keter as it applies to the macro, to the all of humanity. So when we send the thought back to the unconscious and to both, from both levels of the Bina and Hokmah to the Keter, It is compared in the Keter to the overall plan of creation. And if it is going to be dangerous, like you're going to blow up the universe by building atomic energy without safeguards, that's where the Keter would put a stop to it or modify it to include the safeguards. I hope I'm being clearly expressing. I'm continuing to read. Hakma and Bina in the language of Sephirotic faces, Partsufim, are called respectively Abba, the father, and Ima, the mother. This is because Hakma and Bina are metaphorically the parents of thought and thinking. Hakma is referred to as Abba, father, for like the male of the species, it deposits the seed of thought into the womb of Bina. Ima, the mother, like a fetus, a thought grows and develops and becomes a plan. Beginning from the seed of intuition, a thought matures from an embryonic state to a fully mature form, ready to be born into the realm of action. Yet no thought becomes action without motivation. Understanding the deep levels of the Kabbalistic symbolism and the metaphors in the lessons about the Sephirot enables one to better understand oneself and others. This process of going back into the Keter we understand that the thought that enters from the Keter coming into the Hakma and then also into Bina has to be melded and merged and united. But that process of going from Keter to Hakma to Bina and then back to Keter and back to Hakma, where it is evaluated against the plan of creation, the overall understanding of what is the purpose of creation. If that doesn't happen, one could be led very far astray. But as long as it is happening, then you are kept being kept within constraints. You will never destroy the universe. That is a completion of this section, chapter 3. Are there any questions or comments or thoughts?
My thoughts are... We're always continuously building the crown by bringing light and returning light. And the colors of the Sephirot actually are in the crown. So to me, it's like in traveling through the different Sephirot or elevating souls in the different Sephirot, we are actually building this world back to its original creation. And I get a vision of a crown, and each time we do or elevate to a certain Sephirot, we're adding a stone in that crown.
We're actually checking in the crown, does this plan work within the overall constraint of the plan of creation? If it does not, it's going to have to come back down with constraints modifying it. If it does fit within it, then you are right. We are building the crown. But we're changing the crown from the potential to the actual. And that's what we lose sight of. In other words, we haven't gotten there yet in our discussion and definition of Malchut. But how would you understand Keter vis-a-vis Malchut? The Keter being the crown is outside of the body. The Malchut is the manifestation of the plan. It is the building of the physical. Is that the goal? The answer is yes. But it's building of the physical on the level of the nation, not the individual. And that's what is what has to constantly be kept in mind. Hopefully I didn't cut you off.
No,
or interrupt
no.
You.
Okay.
But your thought was well said. You are building the Keter, but we're building the Keter in the sense of manifesting the plan in the physical. But we haven't gotten there yet because we have to have further discussions of the other Sefirot as well as the concept of Dot as well. But we will cover that in future classes. Any other questions or comments or thoughts? We have three more classes today. Our 1 o'clock class, these are West Coast times, our 1 o'clock class, is the advanced reincarnation. Our 4:30 class is deep Zohar class, and our 7 o'clock class is the study from the ideas of the Ari, where a lot of this material comes from its metaphorical perceptions. From its mystical perceptions, which is what the Ari's right brain thinking is being presented. But we don't yet have enough information to understand those things. And that's why the whole process of Kabbalah is to start at the beginning, go to the end, and then start back at the beginning, because you can't understand the beginning unless you understand the end. And the more you understand the end, the more you start back at the beginning. All the cycles are constantly being reiterated. So unless there's another question or comment or thought, you all have a beautiful afternoon. Shalom Gadol to everyone.
Thank you. Shalom.
Shalom.
Thank you.
Thank you. Shalom.